Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a psychosis conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Psychosis is a mental health condition where the individual is not connected to reality, but they don't realize it. They hear voices that are not there, see things that are not real. It can be frightening. It can cause paranoia, violence, depression, and a tough time managing the world. Bryn Spacer was 28 years old when she went on a date with Chad O'Melia. She used marijuana in the past about 8 times. And on this day, she took a hit from a large bong on Chad's coffee table. And at first, she felt nothing. And then she took a second hit. And that was it. She went into full-blown cannabis-induced psychosis. She saw her dead body laying on the ground, and the voices in her head told her to keep stabbing, keep stabbing. She needed to keep stabbing in order to get herself to live. And she listened to those voices. She stabbed her boyfriend 108 times, killing him. She then stabbed her dog and then herself. Police arrived on scene, now recording a gruesome act. And they hit her 8 times with their baton before she finally dropped the knife. Bryn was tried for involuntary manslaughter. Today, she does community service and talks about her experience. If you saw her, you would see a normal young lady. Her psychosis experience was a one-time event. Bryn was lucky in a terrible sense. She survived, although Chad didn't. But she now has a potential future. There are people who use marijuana repeatedly and develop permanent psychosis. Their life is forever destroyed with a lifelong mental health sentence. Researchers, clinicians, and the public wonder what came first, the cannabis use disorder or the genetic predisposition to schizophrenia. How many times can you have a psychotic event from cannabis before the condition becomes permanent? If you stop using weed, will the psychosis go away? A special shout out goes to John Byram from San Diego, who reached out to me to interpret an important but complex medical publication. This podcast answers Byram's question by going straight to that source of that publication. To learn more about cannabis-associated psychosis, I reached out to Dr. Marta DeForte. Dr. Marta DeForte is a clinical psychiatrist in the UK, leading a cannabis clinic for patients with psychotic disorder. She invited me a few years ago to talk to her patients via Zoom. The British patients with cannabis use disorder were fascinated by California cannabis and surprised to learn all the side effects of our much more potent Hollywood weed. In addition to her clinical work, Dr. DeForte is one of the world's premier researchers of cannabis, reviewing large population-based records. Dr. DeForte joined me in a High Truths conversation back in 2022 in episode number 77. She returns now to High Truths with her new research. To learn more about Dr. Marta DeForte, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Marta on February 7th, 2025. Dr. Marta DeForte, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you for having me.
And you are a repeat guest because you're such a prolific researcher that we have more important, very important research that we want to talk about. But before we get to that, tell us a little bit about yourself in terms of your clinical practice, because the last time you were on my podcast and then you invited me to speak to your patients, and that was really amazing. And so you're a clinician and you have an active clinical practice. Tell us about that.
Yes, thank you, Ronit. Actually, your appearance at our peer group was a big hit. So watch for a new invitation. But anyway, so yes, I'm a clinician. So I'm a psychiatrist, and particularly I work with adults between age 18 and 65 who develop for the first time a psychotic illness. And where I work in inner city London, a significant proportion, up to 2/3 of them, would develop the first episode of psychosis in the context of heavy cannabis use, which is why in 2019, we decided to set up, with some initially charity funding, now we are a proper NHS service, a bespoke clinic, which is called the Cannabis Clinic for Psychosis, where if you are under the care of the South London and Mosley NHS Trust, which is a huge NHS trust covering South East London, and you develop psychotic disorder and you are smoking cannabis, you can be referred to us if you wish to explore your relationship with cannabis and make changes to your use, which for the majority of them is actually stopping, but some of them want to reduce or for instance, change the potency. And this is something that has come up in one of our recent publication. And this has been very important to me because we really developed this service following the plea from family, from carers, and also sometimes from patients themselves who would be contacting me because they knew I was interested in the link between cannabis use and psychosis and say, you know, I've developed psychosis in the context of cannabis use. When can I get help? Or lots of parents, I had one yesterday, you know, emailing me and said, my son, my daughter, my loved one. And I, at least in UK, this group of people will fall into the gap between mainstream psychiatry dealing with psychosis and addiction services. Addiction services are wonderful in UK, but they predominantly work with alcohol and opiates, and also require you from the start to have a huge motivation in changing. If you have psychosis, you're paranoid, you're struggling to go out, you need time to develop trust, your motivation might look very low at the start, just because any new intervention that is offered to you require a long period to engage. And so we found that whenever a clinician like me were referring to addiction, people were discharged even before starting or didn't fit with the rest of the people that were receiving care, which goes back to the point of the peer group you came to, where we bring together every Tuesday. Now we have an attendance of 25 on average, people with psychosis and cannabis use across our trust, who come along, hear from experts like yourself. They learn about cannabis, cannabis and psychosis, cannabis dependence, psychosis in general. They ask questions, share their experience. And as a clinician, I have to say that has been a brilliant learning curve for me to hear from them and learn from them.
That's amazing. How is this just outpatient or also inpatient?
No, this is only outpatient, and it's really, you know, is really a sort of baby service. But we work very closely with what is already existing in our trust. So, for instance, to give you an example, up to date, at least 95% of the people we see still use the cannabis with tobacco in the joint. And so we work very closely with our colleagues from the smoking cessation service, because, you know, otherwise it's very difficult to stop your joints when some of the dependence is also driven by the nicotine in the tobacco. We collaborate with people in the inpatient facility because that's a big window of opportunity. You know, when people are admitted with psychosis, if they were using cannabis up to the point of the admission, that they like it or not, they have to stop. And so although this sometimes is difficult at the beginning, we support the inpatient staff in dealing with withdrawal symptoms, if there are, people experience them, but also in engaging them in thinking, well, now you're having a break from cannabis. Are things better or worse for you? Are you noticing that actually after a couple of weeks, maybe you're beginning to be better? You don't need as much medication as before. And so we approach them when they are inpatient, so that when they are discharged, we start working with them from day one, either to support them in maintaining abstinence Or in my experience, day one is when they start and they have the first joint again because they've been missing it very much. And so we help them to start the journey of achieving a proper abstinence and maintaining it.
So how is your caseload? Is there a big demand for this?
So the caseload in our trust is huge. So we have a catchment area of almost 3 million people. And of the one that under our care, I mean, the care of the entire trust, when you look at those with psychosis every year, up to 80% of them would be using cannabis at some point. And so we potentially have a caseload, you know, per year of 500 people. But we can't cope with that. No way. I mean, we are right now a very tiny service with myself as a consultant, so as a senior psychiatrist, if you like. Then we have what we call in UK a dual diagnosis practitioner. So you can be a nurse, you can be a psychologist, or you could have actually just trained in work with addiction and done some course also in working with people who have a major mental illness like psychosis. So we have a senior dual diagnosis practitioner. We're about to re-advertise a post for a junior one and a middle-ish one. So if you can imagine, we only have two permanent member of staff, but what we have, which is the great resource, lots of students. So we are open to clinical placement students. So we have psychologists, medical students who come, they want to gain experience, and they don't gain experience by observing. They do what they say in UK, which is see, do, teach.
Yeah, see one, do one, teach one.
Exactly. So very, you know, after a week of having an idea of what we do, under supervision, obviously, they begin in pairs to take on somebody and do the weekly one-to-one session that represents our main sort of intervention. And I run the peer group. So right now we can really look after probably a third of the people that are referred to us because that's the resource we have. I don't know how it's in US, but right now the NHS in UK and particularly mental health services are under lots of financial strain. So I can't ask more than what I have, but at least because, you know, we are collecting data, we publish our first little paper, we're about to start a proper trial of what we do. Hopefully this will get us more resources.
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but I suspect that you're probably resourced better than we are because I don't know that we even have that, except for maybe for adolescents.
But that's why I don't complain, because at least even if tiny, we exist and we can only grow and we can only share our experience with other parts of the world or even of UK, because we are the only service in UK of its type still. And what we are doing right and wrong can be of help of anybody else that might want to do.
Absolutely. Actually, that's inspiring. Now, you were talking about cessation and tobacco cessation. In the United States, I think financially motivated, physicians, dentists, anybody gets money to get people to stop smoking. We're very into stop smoking cigarettes. And so we have 1-800 lines, all sorts of meths to get people to stop smoking. Cigarettes, if it's cannabis, it's like, well, we're out of luck. There's nothing for you. I'm wondering if you have protocols for cannabis cessation, like we do for tobacco.
So this is a very important question. So first of all, it's interesting what you said, because if in UK we had an incentive, you know, to get a physician to encourage people and support people with stopping cannabis, you know, I would be rich. I would be able to develop a huge clinic. I mean, I wouldn't keep the money for myself. I'd put them in the clinic. So this is a very important question, because we don't by choice. What I mean with that is what we have really received as a very positive feedback from the people under our care, and the one particularly who have completed today the intervention, is that what they find very helpful is that we don't have a fit-all protocol that we say to people, okay, you're smoking 5 joints a day, this is what you have to do over this period of time, because they feel that they want to do it in their own way, in their own time. And if they can't cope, this can be readjusted. So when people start working with us, we begin with taking a very detailed history of what they use, how much they use, the type they use, the time of the day they use. Do they use with tobacco? Do they just smoke it, or sometimes add up with eating and so on? Then we do lots of work in understanding what is cannabis for them. You know, why is cannabis? Why cannabis takes so much of their time, of their life, and so on. And then we set with them their own agenda. So it would be them saying to me, actually, I think perhaps because I'm still going to school or I started going to work, I want to begin with reducing the morning joints. Now, when they do that, how gradually we do it, again, is a bit like if you think what you do in a behavioral program, where you set what the person can cope in terms of the first step of changing behavior. And so this flexibility with this population that also has comorbid psychosis has worked very well, because when we started, we were used to say, okay, you know, we do a reduction of half a gram a day. For some people, half a gram a day was too much. For some people, it was too little. And so we realized that, you know, the flexibility was giving us much better result, and it was much more rewarding for the individual. The same applies to the tools we use across the intervention. So we really use very well established intervention in addiction. We haven't invented anything, but the combination depends on you. So when we do the first two sessions and we begin to get to know each other, we might decide that the best is to do some classic motivational intervention, or we might realize that the person will work very well with some classic cognitive behavioral therapy. There are some people that, because of their psychosis, they have to have a very pragmatic approach. And so the first goal is, how do you save money by cutting down your cannabis? And then the rest might come at a later stage, the more reflective work. So we, out of a toolbox, the combination of the toolbox and the timing is very tailored to the individual.
That's interesting. Do you think that that's because you have such like a difficult population? They all have underlying psychosis and stuff. I'm wondering if for the population at large, you know, like we have tobacco cessation, and I think the world is hungry for some type of guidance in cannabis cessation, which we don't have.
I think what makes the tobacco cessation easier is the access to nicotine replacement therapy, because you can say to people, okay, you know, you want to, whatever, say you're smoking 20 cigarettes a day, you know, this is a protocol you can follow, and these are the, you know, the type of patch you can start from and then move down, or the type of cartridge for your e-cigarette. Because we don't have an equivalent of replacement, you know, a sort of detox or whatever we want to call it, it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. So it's really about the person sort of engaging in a gentle reduction and in replacing the cannabis, perhaps with alternative, with activities rather than drugs. That's what we mostly introducing relaxation technique, or introducing a little bit of exercise on the basis of evidence that suggests that exercise boosts your endocannabinoid system. So if you do exercise, you might get some of the pleasurable effect and the relaxing effect that you get when you, the very beginning, started a very little of cannabis just through the natural endocannabinoid system. But we can do that. You know, you take such cannabis and you add these replacement, because we don't have the equivalent of NRT. Now, there have been some studies.
And then NRT, I'll just say nicotine replacement.
Nicotine replacement, apology. So there is a colleague of mine who's just applied for funding to look at different approaches of harm reduction for the general population. If he gets his funding, I think his main objective is exactly that, to design something for the general population out of what has been seen to work, aiming at harm reduction and protocol of reducing use to either cessation or at least the least harmful pattern of use. but we are not there yet. And certainly I'm more familiar with what works in psychosis, I'm afraid, that what works for the general population, because I'm not an addiction physician.
Well, my advice to him is to don't call it harm reduction. Call it like cannabis cessation or, you know, some type of treatment. So the other thing that when I met your peer group, I was so amazed is what you do to show patients how their own impairment. And you said that you videotape them. Like if they say, oh, I play music better, you know, if I'm high. And then it's like, okay, let's videotape and find out. I think that was amazing.
And I think this is something that would work in the general population. I mean, we all do this. We sometimes think that when we do whatever, we perform better. And, I know lots of friends who would say, oh, well, if I don't have my 2 cup of coffee, I can't give a lecture. And then I'm sure if you give them the option to do it without, they might actually be less fidgety and restless when they give them. But anyway, that's a different story. But we do that a lot. And I think he's giving them a chance to see for themselves rather than trusting my opinion. That is much more powerful. And a classic example is the one of a young gentleman who stopped using cannabis and he decided to go back and look for employment. And so we helped him to apply for jobs and he got his first interview. So he did the interview, came back to us and we said, how did you get on? Oh, well, I think I did very well. Then he didn't get the job. And so I asked him, he daunted me. I said, okay, I know you have stopped using cannabis, but by any chance, did you have a joint before the interview? I said, yes, I had to, because, you know, these kind of situations make me very anxious. And I felt that if for the one-off I did have my joint, I will come across much, much better, much more relaxed and so on and so forth. I said, okay. So we did an experiment where with my students, this is where my students are wonderful, they created a mock interview scenario on Zoom, and he could have his joint before then and, you know, the interview, and they recorded a Zoom interview. And then a week later, they did a mock interview with him off the joint. And we show him the recording and we didn't tell him which was which. And we asked him to rate it.
Oh, that's awesome.
And he rated and he said, you know, he rated one and said, oh, yes, here I was very clear in my speech. I was focused. I was keeping eye contact. I answered to the question, you know, sharply. I didn't go off the tangent like in the other video where I looked actually very chilled and unprofessional. And so then he asked us, which was the two of them? And, you know, and we told him. And he was astonished. The good news is that he did another interview without having a joint and he got a job because he was actually doing very well. So that to me was very important because he really made the point, as a clinician, when I say to my patient not to do things, well, sometimes they don't. But if I can get them to see from themselves that what I'm trying to show them is actually for their own good, not because I have my own agenda, I think it usually works much better, or it works for longer. At least they maintain the goal.
That is amazing. So that kind of talks to the fact that one of the things that cannabis use disorder is associated with is anosognosia. Do you know that word? It's a great word. It's lacking the perception that you are impaired, right? Yes. Classic of the guy that you said, he thinks, oh, I'm doing better on my interview, but he doesn't see what everybody else sees. That's that anosognosia, that he's actually impaired and not doing well.
And to be fair, anosognosia, I don't think is just characteristic of cannabis. I mean, when people develop an addiction, you know, it's very difficult to find somebody who's dependent on a substance who would at least, you know, tell you, oh, yes, this. I mean, some people would say this is very harmful to me, but most people would say, well, actually, I can handle
my liquor. Right?
Exactly. I can handle it. I can stop anytime. Or, yeah. You know, it actually helps me to perform better. Lately we had a wonderful gentleman who was an inpatient, and he is actually a journalist, so somebody very skilled. You know, he was on an inpatient unit, for God's sake, and he was there telling me that he does need his cannabis before he writes an article because that makes him more fluent and creative. well, it's the cannabis that keeps driving him to get admitted to hospital.
Yes.
Of course, I can be brutal and say, well, actually, it sounds like perhaps you do write better article, but then you end in hospital. It's not a very good deal. But it's that journey that people need time to make the link. And it's not, as you said, the agnosognosia comes into interfering with their ability to say, well, why am I keep coming back into an inpatient unit? There must be something I keep doing then.
I know. I run into that so much. It's like, well, my doctor told me to use it to help with my anxiety, and yet you're here in the emergency room.
Yes. Actually, this business of cannabis and anxiety drives me mad because it's about the acute effect. I appreciate that if people have a joint, they feel chilled. We know this is one of the main effects. It's like if you have a little drink and you are in a social context, you become more sociable. But to think that any of us would prescribe alcohol or having a joint, to treat this condition, we know that then what people do, any excuse is a reason to ramp up the use. So it becomes not a one-off, not just before. And then once you use all the time, we know that actually is an inverted U-shaped relationship, the one between THC and anxiety. Little THC might relieve anxiety. You become a regular user, your anxiety goes, shoots off the roof. We know the same with nausea. We know that little THC is a very powerful anti-emetic. You get lots of THC, you end into the emergency room vomiting uncontrollably. Yeah. But people don't get that, and they don't get that they've moved from a very rare occasional to actually is becoming what they do all day long.
Yeah, definitely. So then God, my gosh, I have so many things to ask you. So the other thing I say with anxiety, you're exactly right. You use it first, it's better, and now it makes it through the roof. But also people feel like they need it for the anxiety. And what they're doing is they're really treating their withdrawal, because the withdrawal from cannabis is anxiety, right? So, how do you manage withdrawal symptoms? Do you?
So on the ward, we had a pilot project where we got some funding to do it. And so when people were admitted and they've been heavy users up to the day of the admission, we were allowed to prescribe to them Sativex. Sativex is
THC.
Well, it's THC and CBD equal amount. Okay. So it's an oral mucosal spray, which in UK is licensed for multiple sclerosis. So it's a legal, if you like, cannabis medication. And it has 2.7 milligrams of THC and 2.5 milligrams of CBD in one spray. And you spray under in your mouth. It's an oral mucosal medicine. And so in that case, we did have a protocol. So depending how much people were using, here we deal with an illegal market, so it was a bit of about the frequency and the rough idea of the potency. We would create a sort of little detox and we establish how many puff a day the person was allowed to get from the nurses. So this was not self-administered. People were not going around spraying themselves. They would go to the nurse, up to 8 times a day, and then this would be reduced over a week. So we were able to show that these people were less agitated. They presented less disturbed behavior. They ended needing less tranquilization, if you like. We had a positive feedback from them.
Did you use a Sativex plus the antipsychotic medication?
Yes. They would get, because these were people that
were in severe psychosis. Anyway,
you wouldn't the Sativex would just to take the head off and to remove the withdrawal component out of the presentation. So make sure that they were not over medicated with antipsychotic, because there was the withdrawal component. Mm-hmm. And so we could do this on 10 people. We're still looking at the data. We had no adverse event. There was a bit of concern, you're giving THC, a THC compound to people who are psychotic. Well, the point was, when these people were coming on the ward, this amount of THC compared to what we're using was a drop in the ocean, but at least it allowed us not to get them, more anxious, more distressed. We disrupted sleep, which in turn were all things that were exacerbating the psychosis. So we could do that. If this is something that becomes feasible, I don't know, because Sativex is very expensive. 1 week of Sativex is £450. No way with the current resources we can afford it. There've been some offer from companies of much cheaper cannabis, herbal cannabis product, again with low THC and low CBD, that people could vape. Our hospital is be anxious about using them compared to approved FDA or MHRA for us approved medicine. We'll see. In the community, I was also able to use Sativex for a pilot study, and it did work well for some people. Other people found it didn't like the taste, thought that the mode of consumption was too far from the one they were used to. A bit like smokers that tobacco smoker that tell you that they like e-cigarette because it's like having something in your mouth like a cigarette, but they might don't like the patchy. So some of my patients would say, well, this oral mucosal spray is a bit funny, it's got nothing to do with smoking a joint. So mixed data, but we have tried, the bottom line, to do that. Otherwise we manage withdrawal with benzodiazepine or with antiemetic, depending which is the prominent feature. So if they have insomnia, we temporarily manage the insomnia. If it is anxiety, they get a little bit of benzo. If it is, nausea, they get an antiemetic. So we just deal, or it's a headache, we give them paracetamol. So we just manage. So we keep an eye on them. We use a scale for withdrawal, and we just handle whatever is coming along for the individual.
Interesting. I can hear the United States model of finding like small success with 10 patients and now interpreting that to we need to give everybody marijuana for their,
Yes,
for their
very cool.
withdrawal. So tell us about the UK cannabis market. Is it similar to the United States? You have the regular joints, the bowls, but you also have all the various edibles and candies and drinks and dabs and shatters.
No, not at all. I mean, you have to remember we are still, I mean, recreational cannabis use is still illegal. So we really go from be able to legally buy from a chemist or a health shop pure CBD oil, very low concentration of CBD, by the way, mostly placebo effect, to entirely relying on the illegal market. And the illegal market is in UK still dominated by herbal type of cannabis, pretty high potency, but compared to yours, pathetic. So we might reach 20% THC with very little or no CBD. We have exceptional sort of example of hashish that comes from Morocco, where you might reach 40%, but this would be the exception. It's mostly herbal type of cannabis, which is smoked or anyway inhale in particular type of vaporizer. Not much of edibles. So the people that eat it are people who buy the herbal and then they make cookies with it or cakes in their own house. But in terms of buying candies or drinks, this has not come to
So you
but you
don't
don't
have
have
what we have in the United States, where the number one cause of pediatric poisoning, like 2-year-olds,
No, we don't have that.
is cannabis. You don't have that.
No, we don't have that also because even when people access cannabis in the medicinal market, say you have a grandparent who's getting from a private cannabis clinic cannabis for their pain, the joint pain or the arthritic pain, they will still get it into a vapor, or a portable vaporizer in an herbal format. They won't get tablets or candies. So children really will not be able to, I mean, won't find it appealing to them. No, we don't. I mean, remember you saying that. No, we don't get this in UK.
Nice. And then those real high concentrates, those shatters and dabs, you don't have those.
No, we don't have
Or
them.
the oils. Nice.
I mean, you can online potentially get them, but they're very, very used because they're also quite expensive. So it's not common.
And then what about like in the United States also, we have all the new psychedelics and mushrooms. You could buy them on Amazon. So this whole proliferation of other drugs, not just cannabis. Are you seeing that as well?
We're not seeing that as much. I mean, some of the psychedelic or the mushroom are sort of more common in other parts of Europe, like in Germany. UK is the main drug of consumption remain, well, cannabis, cocaine. We're beginning to get more methamphetamine and opiates. These sort of are really small pockets, and it's never regular use. So it's, you know, you might have a rev party with people, you know, sell them and use them for one night, but we don't really have it into a regular use pattern. Not yet, anyway.
Yeah. And your medical, I wonder if is your medical market really medical? Like, for example, I would say Israel's probably a gold standard for medical, where the marijuana is made in germ cell lines, you know, in a sterile hood, not grown on the ground with pesticides. Yeah. It's mixed in a pharmacy. It's prescribed very specifically and strictly with dosages that you can count on. The American medical market is not at all like that. It is identical to the recreational market, but just sold in a store that has more rules. No prescriptions, no interactions, no, you know, there's no guarantee that you're not getting, you know, arsenic or aspergillus or whatever else in that plant. And I'm wondering how is your medical market?
So we have two phases of our medical market, the NHS one. So if you get, say you are referred to an NHS pain clinic.
And what's NHS?
Sorry, it's a National Health Service.
Okay.
So if you go to, you know, an hospital that has got a pain clinic, and this is a national health hospital, you can have pain physician who can prescribe, approved by the equivalent of the FDA, cannabis product that will come either as drops, or they will come as an oral mucosal spray. They don't come as herbal product, by the way. And they will have the leaflet, like any other medication, saying the dose, depending from the condition, your age, sometimes it's by weight and so on. And usually these are for the condition where they've been clinical trial. So some of the pain condition, you know, multiple sclerosis, again, nausea, particularly in chemotherapy use or HIV. And so in this, or in epilepsy for the CBD. So for instance, if you are a physician, neurologist in UK, under the National Health Service prescribe cannabis medication, this would be pure CBD product. The main one is called Epidiolex. And it is produced by a farmer that has exactly what you say, a legal plantation of cannabis where things are done in a very controlled way. I actually went and visited it. And so it is done as a pharmaceutical product with high level of control. You don't get a little bit of leaf and you give them to your child in an herbal tea. I mean, this looks like a medication with the dosing for the child. But there is lots of confusion, because if then you go to the private clinics, there are lots of cannabis clinic, private clinics in UK, you might see a clinician, you know, a physician, and then you go and say, well, I have pain. And they say, oh, well, fair enough. You know, I can see you have rheumatoid arthritis. And then you get an approval from the physician. You go down to the chemist of the cannabis clinic, and you are given a herbal sample to take home and use. And the concept of a dose, like classically we physicians are used to, this amount, such and such times a day, the idea of monitoring side effects alongside beneficial effect, no. I had patients with psychosis going to these services, saying that they had psychosis and being given a prescription of 22% of THC and being back in a compulsory admission 2 weeks later, which drove me bananas. We had 50-year-old lady who never had a mental health problem going to this clinic, getting high doses of THC for their pain, using it throughout the day, every day, and presenting for the first time with a psychotic episode, coming out of hospital, going back to the clinic and getting a new prescription. So if you ask me, totally unregulated.
No, it's also insulting to the medical profession.
Totally.
We can't give Tylenol that way, or amoxicillin. It's
I mean, even paracetamol, I always say to my patients, you don't, if when you have a day, take paracetamol throughout the day. You know, if you look at the leaflet of paracetamol, if you do that, might as well do, then you end with liver damage in INE. So this idea that something that we call a medicine can be used leisurely throughout the day as you like it, it's recreational. I'm with you.
Yeah, better just to call it that.
Yes.
That's pretty amazing. And then, so, you know, obviously you're working in a psychiatric clinic and you have a clinic just for yourself, but are your emergency departments inundated with cannabis-induced psychosis, cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, and things like that we see in the United States where every day we see a cannabis-associated emergency?
So definitely we see cannabis. So my colleagues from what we call, you know, the work in INE see cannabis associated psychosis on daily basis. Hyperemesis, when you and I spoke last time, have not been seen in UK, or at least reported. Now, I mean, I had recently emailed from colleagues in INE and said we saw these. Can it really be cannabis? And sharing with them the literature coming from the States, and this is because we are having particularly young people, you know, teenagers who are beginning to vape it and pure THC. And even if it's not as powerful as the one you have in the States, you know, if you vape a 22% THC all day long from being completely cannabis naive, you very easily end in INE. So we're getting it particularly in the teenagers.
Yeah, I think if you pay attention, you'll see it more. You know, I recently went and I volunteered at a hospital in Israel, and I was listening to the doctors do their morning rounds, and they're talking about this patient who has abdominal pain, and he's been in different hospitals, and no one can figure it out, and they were deciding on whether to do the CAT scan. And I just kind of came into the story, and I said, you know, if this was the United States, it would be cannabis hyperemesis syndrome. They all looked at me, and they said, he smokes, he gets medical cannabis. And it's like, well, that's what it was. And then I went and I talked to him, and he had one of those medical prescriptions, you know, legitimate, for he has like a little contracture in his leg. He uses it every day. And I, you know, talked to him about like this could be the thing and to expect withdrawal and everything. And, you know, that's the diagnosis. The problem is that diagnosis won't go back to the doctor who's prescribing it, right? So the loop won't be closed.
Yeah. And my experience, and I don't want to say by all means this applies to all the doctors prescribing cannabis in UK, is that even when he gets back to the doctor, I don't know how much it would make a difference to some of the people prescribing it privately. But, you know, hopefully it will not apply to everybody. But it's interesting what you say. I agree. I've been wondering how much it is underdiagnosed, and we are beginning in our trust to do some training with the staff in INE, because it is not what people would think. I mean, these colleagues did ask me, does this exist? Which tells me that in their occasion, for whatever reason, they had the doubt and they asked me. You wonder how many other times people came along with hyperemesis and am I still investigating it? You would have seen there was a quite nice, I thought, article in the New York Times just before Christmas that talked about cannabis in general in the States. And they, among the stories, they had one of a lady who went through, I think she was from Colorado, several investigation endoscopy in, for the reason we are saying. And then it turned out that it was actually a cannabis use, that he was legitimately prescribed again for pain. And it was when she reduced and stopped the cannabis use, then the nausea, the cramps and everything.
Right, right. And it's important to educate physicians, because these people have like 5-10 CAT scans, because you're searching for something and you're like harming them now with all the radiation instead of just stopping. Anyway,
fascinating. And then, you know, and the cost to for you, to insurances and people, and to us, to the national.
I guarantee you have that problem in the UK. If you have a clinic dedicated to psychosis with potential 500 patients a year just from the psychosis, then I know that you have that.
When people come to me and say, well, you know, I can't stop using my cannabis because if I do, you know, I get stomach cramps and vomiting. You know, I always say to them, well, the stomach cramps and vomiting is not you stopping. I mean, for some of them, usually it's the withdrawal. but it is also the effect, you know, the effect of the THC. So at least, I mean, we know, but we are again, if you.
And sometimes we say, does hot showers help you? And you know, and in the milder cases, it does. But when it's so severe, then they're in the emergency department. And we've had people die.
And so yeah, of course.
Yeah, from it. All right. I want to get to your research because that's really, but this conversation was so interesting. I really wanted to get the background. Recapping previous research. Okay. Just, you know, for the audience to understand what we already have, because your current research goes beyond that. But established research, I think I'll make 4 points and you tell me if I captured it enough for as far as a big research or if there's more that I'm missing. But the research that we know already, number one is the risk for psychosis. And we could say, based on your European studies, that the risk factor of getting psychosis from cannabis is fivefold if you use everyday high potency. And your definition of high potency was more than 10%. And then the recent Canadian study by Dr. McDonald, who was also on
fantastic study. Yes. Fantastic.
Yeah. He was on this podcast where he said that the risk factor is 11-fold for ages 12 to 19. So that's one, I think, big point that I think is established. The other one is the relationship of potency, right? Like if higher potency, more likely to have psychosis. And the third point is the conversion. Like any drug, like you said, can cause psychosis. And if you continue to do that, you could have permanent schizophrenia. But cannabis, more than methamphetamine or other drugs, has a higher conversion rate. And then the final point, and I think this is from your studies too, that if we really wanted to tackle mental health, if we targeted men between age 21 and 30 and avoided them from having cannabis use disorder, we could prevent 30% of schizophrenia cases. So did I capture that?
Yeah, that's perfect. I mean, the only thing about the 30% of schizophrenia cases, I would like to say, because people get very, very happy about this. This would be in the population where in the study the people came from. So this would be in South London. When we look at the same question in Amsterdam, it was actually up to 50%.
Wow.
And so that's the what we call the population attributable fraction. So the proportion of new cases of psychosis that you can attribute to, and particularly that was a high potency cannabis. So it's really dependent from population, because it depends on how prevalent the use is in the population. And I would like to say, we're talking about in these studies a concept of high potency cannabis that is 10%. For you in the States, that's pathetic. So we don't, I mean, if we think about replicating what has been done experimentally, that the relationship between cannabis use and psychosis is dose dependent. So more you use, more potent it is, greater is the risk. If you think that at 10%, you have a 50%, potentially 30%, depending where you are, number of new cases that can be accounted for by high-potency cannabis. When high-potency cannabis is 40, 50, 60, 90%, you can easily expect these percentages to be much greater.
Yeah, which is huge. Like we said, we have a mental health crisis in the United States. We do not have beds and facilities. If we could do this one thing, that would be, I think, like low-hanging fruit of an intervention. Okay, so now that with that background of established research, you've come up and you're back on High Truths for the new publications. And the one that came across many people's emails all over probably the world was your study on the impact of schizophrenia genetic load and heavy cannabis use on the risk of psychotic disorder in the EU GEI case control and UK biobank studies. That sounds very complicated, but also very important. So explain it to us. Maybe start with who are the patients here that are being studied?
So we have two different, and that's where the EUGI, UK Biobank come from. So we have two independent studies, two independent population. So the EUGI study, this is where EU comes from, is a multi-center European study that includes 11 sites across France, UK, Italy, the Netherlands, and Spain. And the UK Biobank, on the contrary, is a huge population study from the UK. So in the European study, we have a group of people who have developed psychosis for the first time, so what we call first episode psychosis patients. And then we have people from the general population from each of the area where the patient come from. So it's a case control design. When the UK Biobank is a population study, so you have this huge population sample from the UK, and then you have data in both set of study on the people that have psychosis and how many of them have used cannabis and how frequently they were using cannabis, and also data from DNA to establish what is the genetic load, so that the genetic predisposition to develop a psychotic disorder. So what we really wanted to do, and we started our primary analysis, was in the UGI study. Because in the UGI, we have more detailed information about what people were using, the potency, and so on, was to see if what some people have mentioned, which is that, well, yes, it's true that a minority of people, when they use cannabis, they develop psychosis. But the reason is that they have lots of genes for schizophrenia, and they would have developed schizophrenia anyway. And they were actually, if anything, using cannabis to feel a bit better and more chilled. So we look into that. And so, first of all, we looked if having lots of gene for schizophrenia, which is what in the studies called the polygenic risk score for schizophrenia, is really a summary statistic of the genetic load. So say you have, Ronit, you have a polygenic risk score of 10 and I have one of 20. It just means that I have more gene for schizophrenia than you. You know,
what is this? Is this a blood test? Is this a blood test where you're
the blood test? This you don't. It doesn't have to be from a blood test. It can be from a saliva specimen. But okay. In our case, it was from blood test. You extract the DNA. You look across the whole genome. So you look across the whole genetic code of the individual, and then you identify the one that now we know be the genes that are more likely to be associated with the risk of schizophrenia. And depending how many you have, you have a greater load or a lower load.
I find that astonishing that across the UK, you're doing these blood tests. I don't know that we're doing this in the United States.
No, but this is research. We can't do them in clinical practice either.
Okay.
And actually, in UK, you do it too. Actually, in UK, there are companies like 23andMe that you can send as a private individual. I've done that. Your spit, you know, and use your mouth cell to estimate your risk for many disorders. So in research, you can do this routinely. In clinical practice, we don't do that. But it's becoming cheaper and cheaper, so who knows in the future. So you can get this measure of your genetic load for schizophrenia. So first question was, is it true what people say, that the one that use lots of cannabis are the one with lots of these genes, and they do that to ameliorate the symptoms? So we look at that, and we found, no way. How many genes you have for schizophrenia has got nothing to do with your chances of using cannabis for the first time or using a lot of it. So these are two independent things. So the genetic for schizophrenia does not explain you starting cannabis for the first time. The other thing we looked at was, if we run the analysis you mentioned before, so we see how much using cannabis every day and of high potency increases individual risk for psychosis. And you said that is increases of 5 times. What happens if we control how much genetic load for schizophrenia people have? Does this wash out the relationship between cannabis and schizophrenia? No. So even when you take into account statistically the contribution of the genetic load for schizophrenia and the relationship between cannabis and the risk of developing the condition, the link between cannabis and psychosis remains significant, which means that the way genetic risk for schizophrenia increases your chance of developing a psychotic disorder, and heavy cannabis use increases your risk of developing a psychotic disorder, are two independent risk factors from each other. So you can get schizophrenia and psychosis because you got lots of cannabis use, or because you have lots of genes. Of course, if you have both, it's worse. But that in medicine would apply to anything. You know, if you have a high genetic load for diabetes type 2 and you eat donuts all day, you don't do yourself a favor.
So, Marta, that is huge. That's a huge research breakthrough, and to answer a very important practical question.
Which doesn't, and I think it also reconciles the two point of view. It is indeed true that if you have lots of genes for schizophrenia, and for whatever reason, because you are told it's good to reduce your anxiety, and you use cannabis, then you develop schizophrenia, and that might be also to do with your genes. But it's also true that there are lots of people out there who are using enough cannabis to get to psychosis, even if they had a very low genetic risk, which means that without cannabis, they wouldn't have got there.
That's right. Prevention. Hello. Prevention.
Exactly. That's a huge, for us, that we struggle with prevention in psychiatry. That's a huge prevention opportunity.
That's huge. That's very, very important. And I hope the world gets to know that. That's, yeah, you need to have this. I need to have this promoted more than my podcast. I think that's very, very important to anybody. This is probably like a key study for anybody who's working on drug prevention to know.
And I think it's also something good to relay to people and engage them because, you know, sometimes people say to me, oh, you know, but I have a family history of psychosis. So maybe that's why I'm unwell. So and cannabis makes me chilled. So why should I stop? And is to be able to show to them, well, you know, you might as well have your family history. And it could be that for other reasons you would have developed, but it probably was cannabis that tipped you over the threshold. Not everybody with a family history of psychosis develops psychosis. It's not a 100% association. So even if there is a 50% of chance to stay well, and on top of that you put cannabis, that reduces much less than 50% chances of stay well. So I think it's an important message, even in the world when people might don't have a chance to get their genetic load at the molecular level, but they know that they have a family history. You know, they are certainly a group to watch for, but also everybody else should be careful.
Yeah, wow, it's very important. Now, your other study was cannabis use cessation and the risk of psychotic disorder, a case control analysis from the first episode case control EUGEI WP2 study. Okay, now again, sounding complicated, but it has to do with stopping cannabis and psychotic risk. So tell us about that study.
So the idea of this study, which is again a study that we conducted in the multi-center European study that's got its funny name that I mentioned before. So we got the idea from what we know about tobacco, you know, cigarette smoking, that we know that many longitudinal studies have shown that actually stopping tobacco use, cigarette smoking, it's worthwhile because longer you abstain over time, you can reduce some of the risk you have accumulated, for instance, for lung cancer. So we wanted to see if we could give people an incentive as well in relation to cannabis. And what we did find, and of course, our study was limited to the fact that we could only study people who had stopped for a maximum of 500 weeks, because these are what the data we had. So we know that within a window of 500 weeks, when we look at people with different combination of frequency and again, potency, we found that really for all of them, longer people have been able to abstain from cannabis. So after having used, they decided to stop, and longer they have abstained, lower was becoming the risk of developing a psychotic disorder. But when you look at the people who had been using high potency, again, our wimpish definition compared to US of 10% every day, they took longer for a reduction and they actually don't go down to zero. They still have a 25% increased risk compared to people, for instance, who have been using rarely and lower potency. So this is still a group for whom you might have a reversibility of the risk, but it takes longer. It certainly is not enough 500 weeks, but also, you know, we don't know if it actually washes out completely. So that's definitely a pattern of use, which we are consistently seeing to be associated with harder harmful effect and least with prevention opportunities.
Now, I want to make sure I understand this better, because I would imagine that if you had one episode of psychosis and you stop, then your chances of recovery are better. But if you've had 10 years of cannabis-induced psychosis, and by now the psychiatrists don't even care about this cannabis. They just call you schizophrenia. Your chance of recovering are much less.
No, these are not people who have developed. So these are people in the general population. So this is a study that is looking at, say, you and I, we never had psychosis, and we have been using for a while, and then we read one of these studies, and we say, oh gosh, am I going to develop psychosis? So we might have we might be at risk of developing psychosis because how much we have used. But if we decide to stop today, and we actually manage to be abstinent, longer we stay abstinent, less likely you and I are, given that women have a second peak of onset of psychosis, to develop psychosis for the first time. So this is primary prevention. This is about people out there with cannabis use disorder who have never developed psychosis, who are wondering, is it worthwhile stopping using cannabis? Would I, if I stop using cannabis today, prevent my risk of developing psychosis in the future?
But getting into the brain of somebody who uses cannabis, wouldn't the logic be is like, wait, I've been using this for 5 years. I don't have cannabis use disorder. I don't have psychosis, so I could keep using. What's the big deal?
Well, it's the same people with lung cancer. I mean, the people that smoke tobacco, they say, oh, well, I've been using for 10 years. I'm still well. Why do I need to stop tobacco smoking? Well, we might develop lung cancer next year or in 2 years' time. So we know that prevention is not an easy message.
But does psychosis work that way? Like,
does for some people. Some people need to smoke cannabis for 5 years before developing psychosis. Mm. There are people, and I know you see more of them because of the high potency. You have a quick hit. You might see people that use for a week or 2 days and come to I&E. But when we look at the people who have a conversion, or we look at people who then develop a more established psychosis, they tend to be people who have used cannabis for a long time.
So if somebody says, I've been using cannabis for 5 years, I don't have psychosis, I can't tell them that maybe tomorrow you will.
But you can't tell the opposite either. So you can't tell them they won't.
And
it's the same with lung cancer. You know, people want to take a chance, fine, but at least now they know that if they make a decision to stop, this risk will reduce. I mean, when you look at all the longitudinal studies from Europe and some from the US, the majority of people start using cannabis at age 16. And when you explore the link between the cannabis use and psychosis, these are people who develop the psychosis at age 20, 21. So for the majority of people, when we have explored all the studies that have explored the link between cannabis and psychotic disorder, including schizophrenia, they have a gap of almost a decade sometimes.
But I think that that's because of, again, for you're seeing that with the market. What we're seeing now also, I think that that's true. But we have the older population who are being pushed to using their gummies. And now they're coming with the first psychotic break at age, 50, 60.
And again, this is a population that's been understudied. We don't know if they need a less exposure to develop psychosis for a variety of reasons, less efficient metabolism, we don't know. But there might also be people of an older age group, say my age group. I mean, it's becoming very popular in UK to offer cannabis for menopause. So say I start using tomorrow to ameliorate menopause symptoms. I might develop cannabis in a week, but I might develop it in 5 years' time. So I think the point is, because we haven't established yet, and this is not a recipe for everything or for everybody, a time link where we can guarantee people, if you're at risk, if after two weeks or 1 month or 3 years, you have developed psychosis. Otherwise, you are a safe user, go on for the rest of your life. We don't know this because the variation is so huge. My point is, now we do know that even if you have been using quite a lot, if you then make the decision to abstain, you can actually have an impact on the risk driven by cannabis to develop psychosis. And I think that's a very important message of potential reversibility, but also of empowering people to make a decision. If then they want to continue because they think they're absolutely safe, that's a different story, but at least now they know.
Yeah, that's very important. All right, that's been very enlightening, important studies, and you continue to work clinically and do your research, which is a great combination because it means, it brings meaning to your research. It's immediately applicable, which was
I like. But I would like to say, Ronnie, before I go, this is not me. I mean, of course, you're talking to me, and it's a privilege for me to relay to you what my team has been done. and has been doing, but it is a teamwork, both clinically and research. And, you know, I'm very blessed because I have wonderful postdoc researcher who are all very skilled at all the technical aspects of the research. You know, we do. Without them, I couldn't be here. And the patients I work with who inspire me every day and contribute actively to inform and guide the research I do. So without them, I wouldn't be here.
Yes, and they're named in your publications. They're a long list of names, not just not,
you
not
see
just
that. Yes,
yes, yes. Okay, conclusion. What can you briefly summarize what we know for sure today about cannabis and psychosis?
Well, we definitely know that using cannabis, and particularly using cannabis every day, high potency variety, does significantly increase your risk of psychotic disorder. And this increase can be fivefold, 11-fold, depending where you are and how potent is the type of cannabis you use. We know now from Canada that has published this week a fantastic longitudinal study on 14 million people that in places like Canada, where they've legalized cannabis, there's been a tripling in the number of new cases of psychosis associated with heavy cannabis use. We know that this is not explained just by the genetic of schizophrenia. Even people who have very little predisposition to schizophrenia, if they use lots of cannabis, can become psychotic and can develop a chronic version of psychosis, which is schizophrenia. You don't want to do this. This will disrupt your work life, your educational life, your family life, your overall life trajectory. So it's a huge preventive strategies, and people have a chance to make the decision and be supported in making the decision of stopping their cannabis use.
And then what big questions do we still have that we need to research?
Well, some of the questions you have asked me, for instance, so do we know who are the people that are safe to continue to use, at least in relation to psychosis? We don't, because compared to alcohol use, and even in alcohol use, this is not perfect, but we don't have yet an established unit where we can say, if you exceed this unit, you have really at pretty much 100% risk of developing psychosis. We don't know how, even when we develop units and we are getting there, these would be different by gender, by age, perhaps even by ethnicity. Nobody has really, and we're beginning to do that in my group, look how what metabolizes cannabis, so the way you clear out cannabis compound might play a role on how susceptible you are to the psychosis. We don't know if there are specific set of genes that really push some people to be the most at risk. So there are lots and lots of things that will keep me busy, luckily, for the next few years, and so that the rest of the research community. And then the more translational question, could we develop a detox program for people who want to come off cannabis? And is there a program that would be more bespoke to people in the general population compared to people with psychosis? How do we keep people who legitimately can access medicinal cannabis because it has been proved that works in their condition? How can we keep them safe? What should we have in place to monitor that the side effects such as psychosis don't sort of trump the attempt to be beneficial for the health? So there's still lots of questions, both in the clinical applied field and in research, I think, that we need to look at.
And when you say conversion, I should have clarified this way earlier, but conversion from psychosis, which is a symptom of, you know, in reality, to schizophrenia, do you also include bipolar and other psychotic?
Well, so studies have been done predominantly with schizophrenia. For bipolar, there's beginning to be more and more evidence suggesting that bipolar with psychosis is also increased by cannabis use. Bipolar without psychotic symptoms, the evidence are not really clear. Depression with psychotic symptoms. So you can have depression with psychotic symptoms. In that case, cannabis plays a role. You can have bipolar, so you can be manic and have psychotic symptoms. In that case, cannabis does play a role. Without psychosis, the evidence are not really clear.
That's great. Dr. Marta De Forte, I'm going to say your doctor name anyway at the end here, but it's been a pleasure, very enlightening. Continue your great work. I think there's a lot for us to learn around the world from your research and clinical experience. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Ronit, for having me. And thank you for your wonderful question. It's always great and a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug-Free America Foundation. Visit dfaf.org. And ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.